Mr. Masonry the Seventh.
Decided to get married and hopefully live happily ever after. We've had two children, a boy and a girl. One, the boy went into the Merchant Navy as a deck officer. My daughter trained as a nurse in Westminster Hospital. She became an SRN and a state certified midwife, and now happily married with two children of her own. Son has two children of his own, and everything has gone well.
Did you find it difficult to readjust to civilian life after the war?
Everyone did. I'm sure everyone did. You'd left your family, which was the army, your friends, many friends, and it was a blow. There was no question about it. It was a blow. I mean, there's no question about it, in the army you are cared for, what anyone likes to say. You are looked after. You know where you're going most of the time. You're clothed, you're fed, you're transported. And I liked it. I liked the army, the wartime army. But from what I have seen of the peacetime army, I certainly would not have liked to have been in it, especially if I'd been married. Although I still got a great affection for the British Army, there's no question about it.
Why would you not have liked to have been in the peacetime army?
I think for a woman, you have to be a very special type to be a serviceman's wife, irrespective of rank. I think the trials and tribulations that they go through, the wives, most of them put up with it very well. But it is a different way of life. But that applies to any of the services.
You seem to suggest, from what you said earlier, that you'd become almost institutionalized with everything being provided for you.
Yes, I'm quite sure. I'm quite sure we were all institutionalized. If you take on this this job, or you're a soldier or a sailor or an airman or whatever, you belong to that particular institute, and the institute looks after you.
Did you find it difficult to relate to civilians who'd not been through wartime service life?
At the start, yes.
Did they seem to have different attitudes and ways of going?
Oh, very much different attitude. In fact, most of the time, even now, when I speak to somebody, I can tell almost immediately whether they've been in the services or not. There's an unspoken sort of comradeship somewhere along the line. And from the look of a man somehow, the way one speaks to t'other one, you know somehow, yes, you've seen some service, or particularly people of my age, whether it's ex-paras or Dunkirk veterans or ex-SOE. And there's this affinity, you see, which immediately you can communicate all the time. You never fail, or very rarely fail, to communicate. And I think this is something which I'm glad I didn't miss, you know, and feel sorry for people that haven't had the opportunity to get that sensation, that feeling. It is basically comradeship. I don't think there's any other word for it.
Coming back to Malaya, did the group that you joined have a special name? Some special code name, for example?
No, but the group, the operation, was called Sergeant. And I got a note of that in my book. It's actually spelt wrong. It's spelt S-E-J-E-A-R-N-T.
That's the correct spelling, is it?
S S-E-G, Segend it's spelled, is it? Something like that. I'll show it to you in a minute. And this was the operation. Well, where it came from, I don't know. But it's not in any records, and it's not in the book, Cruikshank's book.
Now, for Cruikshank's book, we should say, is SOE in the Far East?
Yes, well, this is the Far East, is what we're talking about. He names many of the operations, but as he says, he doesn't know all of them. The operations in Burma and Malaya, they were named. And Jeff Bence has told me that he knows that they were named sometimes after, oh, I don't know, could it be flowers or plants or bushes or something? Perhaps a combination of things. But each operation had its name. But you see, well, that was possibly the name I've given you. It was the name of the operation I was on. But as I say, that isn't mentioned in Cruikshank's book. But then there must be a lot of things that he can't possibly know. Now, the other thing about this service in SOE in the Far East, my service record shows I joined the army at such and such a time, I went to the Middle East at such and such a time, I went to India, and I came back from India. Anything in between to do with SOE is not mentioned. As far as my army records are concerned, I never left India. I never went to Malaya. I never came back from Malaya.
Why is that?
Because it wasn't recorded. If you were on a clandestine operation, I suppose, no one said, well, this chap's going off virtually on an illegal operation outside the international rules of war. I mean, would it appear on your record? As far as I know, it doesn't appear on mine.
Now, one other thing that I think we ought to say is that I have in front of me now a map of part of Kedah in front of me, which shows the exact place where you dropped.
Yes.
And this particular sheet is entitled Kedah, second edition, part of Baling and Sikh districts. And it says, refer to this map as Hind 1035, sheet 2¼. And according to the mark that you've put on the map, you landed in the southeast corner of grid square 71-35. And you can see that it's up in the north eastern corner of the map.
Yes, quite close to the Siamese border. And one of the extraordinary things there was that our landing eight-figure map reference, not six, eight-figure map reference, was at the joining of two streams. And when we worked out the map reference where I dropped, it was within yards of that map reference. That was an extraordinary thing. And couldn't have been anywhere else because I landed just where the junction of these two streams on the map was shown. And that's where I dropped in. Which is extraordinary. Not good dropping, but I mean luck, wasn't it? To drop exactly where they said I'd drop.
Yes, perhaps it was a combination of luck and skill on the part of the navigator.
Yes, to find this particular patch in the jungle, which, as I said, couldn't have been more than half an acre of chopped down trees, he had to look for the smoke of fires, and this is what he headed for. And of course, as soon as he found this clear patch amongst the thick green of the jungle, he knew he was spot on. So he just circled that patch, dropped the containers, they were always the first to go, and then dropped the bodies. And he did the exact run, he possibly did the run around the DZ three times, and on the last run, as I say, the green light came on, and away we slid. Oh, he was spot on, all right. Of course, he'd done it a few times before. Later, funnily enough, before I jumped, the Canadian dispatcher, I think he acted dispatcher and air gunner, said, can you turn around in your parachute when you go out, because you're going out feet forwards? And I said, yes. I said, why? He said, well, I want to take a photograph of you going out. So I said, and I was the last one out, you see, so I said, right. So just as soon as the parachute opened, I did a turn. You do that by crossing the webbing, which I wish I hadn't done afterwards, because I started to oscillate, you see. And that was that. I just saw the tail of the liberator disappear. And I started to oscillate a bit, but straightened up enough to go down into the trees fairly straight. Well, now, later, when the liberation came, after the surrender, we were still there, I had to take a truck down to a place called Butterworth, an airfield opposite Penang Island, the RAF airfield there, because there were two liberators coming in to us, or one to us, full of stores which we'd ordered, which they were still sending, which had been loaded, ready to drop. But instead of dropping, they decided to land at Butterworth. And my instructions were, go down to Butterworth with the truck and pick up those stores from the liberator. So down I went with a big Toyota truck, which we'd pinched from the Japanese. So I drove it down and saw the RAF commander, I suppose, on the field, and told him why I was there. And he said, well, that's all right. He said, they're due in any minute now. Now, to get into that airfield, the liberators had to come in, not, I suppose the wind was wrong, I don't know. They have to come over the hill and do a steep drop onto the landing ground, onto the strip. It isn't anything more than a strip, I suppose it's bigger today. And the first one that came in almost crashed. It came in so steeply and landed with a most horrendous crash. Bounced, this huge liberator bounced down the runway and stopped. Then the next one following came in and did a beautiful landing, and by this time I was right by the edge of the strip, the runway as it went past. And I could see at once that was the aircraft that had dropped me in, because the air gunner was looking out of the port at the back, and he obviously spotted me. We were so close, and I waved to him. So I dashed up to him when they sorted themselves out and landed. This was the one I was waiting for. And we all greeted each other, the pilots all came over and shook hands, you see, to see that I'd actually survived the drop. And I said to this fellow, the Canadian, I said, did you get the photograph? And he said, well, he said, I just got the top of your parachute. He said, I was hoping for your smiling face, he said, but all I got was the top of your chute. And that was it. So we had a little get-together on the airfield, and I took all the stores back in the truck to our headquarters up at Alastair, where we were at the time.
How did the communist guerrillas in Malaya compare with the Greek guerrillas that you were with?
Very well disciplined. And finally, after all the stores had been dropped into them, clothing and so on, very smart indeed. Now, one of the final parades which we attended, they marched well, they were well armed. Virtually everyone carried a M1 American carbine. They had Brens, and they were a force to be reckoned with if they'd ever started or thought about attacking the forces that were in the Malaya at the time. Because, you see, our forces were so thinly spread that they could have done to us exactly the same thing as the Japanese did. I really, to this day, can't quite understand why they didn't attempt to completely take over Malaya. But finally, there, what happened, in that consignment that had come from Colombo, which was most important, was a huge consignment of cash in new Malayan dollars, paper money, which I collected in a great waterproof packet. Took it back to our headquarters where the CO, Alexander, opened it up and was full of, I don't know how many, thousands and thousands of Malayan dollars. And that was meant to pay off each guerrilla, and he received 200 Malayan dollars in exchange for his rifle or pistol or whatever else he'd been issued with. And he was also given the Burma Star ribbon and the war medal, British War Medal. And all these were in this huge package. And so teams of us set out to the various little headquarters where these people had gathered. And as the guerrillas came up, they'd been told what was to happen. They handed over their weapon, the personal weapon. They were given the $200 and presented with this two ribbons on the bar. And, of course, we were told to pay out $200 for each weapon, but if you'd seen the junk that came in, you know, old rusty shotguns and old pistols that would never fire, and, of course, in many cases, they'd kept back the good stuff, you see. The lovely American carbines and things like that. But as long as they handed over a weapon, there was nothing we could do about it. So thousands of those weapons must have been kept in the jungle for subsequent attacks on the British during the Malayan Troubles. And there must have been literally millions of rounds of ammunition. So they were well armed, even at that time.
Now, we also have in front of us here, from your scrapbook, one of these three-star badges, and it's a piece of red cloth with a green circular piece of cloth superimposed, and then the three red stars superimposed on that at the corners of an equilateral triangle.
Yes, this green was the parachute silk with the red border and the red three red stars. And this is where the name Tiga Bintang comes from, the three stars. And the guerrillas wore these, when they were wearing uniform, as flashes. They wore a single red star on their caps, but those three on the sleeve of their battle dress or whatever they were wearing. Now, at some stage, we were called on a sort of parade, all of us in the jungle, and presented with one of these badges, which had a safety pin on the back. And we pinned these up. We went along with this, you see, because we thought it was very odd for the British Army to be wearing, or members of the British Army, to be wearing a communist guerrilla badge. So, but we wore them, and that was that. Well, now, a few weeks later, we drove down, that's Colonel Alexander and me, drove down to Penang in a Ford which we'd taken from the Japanese, big Ford Mercury, and we were going to take it across to Penang, and we were waiting at the quayside there when the ferry came in. Two things happened, interesting things. We were both wearing these flashes. The first was Alexander, who spoke, as I say, perfect Hindi, dashed across to speak to a Sikh, in a bearded Sikh, tall, good-looking fellow, called me over. Harry, I was known as. Harry, come and shake this man's hand, this chap's hand. So I walked over, and without knowing the reason why, shook this Sikh's hand, who was grinning at me. He was a Subedar. Subedar. And then I looked at his medals and I saw that he was wearing the VC. So Alex said there, he said, you won't do that very often. So I saluted him, of course. And he talked away in Hindi for a time. And then he saluted and left. The ferry came in and two British officers jumped off. And by this time, Alex was still talking to the Sikh, I think. And these two people jumped off, two captains, looked very much political officers, and took one look at my sleeve and just about went mad, seeing these three stars. And one of them absolutely raved at me. He said, you can't wear that. He said, what do you think you're doing, you see? And I said, well, we're SOE, we've just come from the communist camp. Well, that's all very well, you're not wearing that. I said, well, you better speak to my colonel about this. So I called over the colonel, you see. Well, of course, the poor chaps couldn't say a word. So, but it was a bit amusing. But anyway, when we got on the ferry, we then took them down, you see, and thought, well, this is too much of a good thing. We better not continue with this wearing of communist insignia. And so we did. We took them down. I brought mine home. There can't be too many of them around in this country anyway. So it's rather nice to have it.
Did the communist guerrillas in Malaya have women amongst their ranks?
Oh, yes, they did indeed. But when the, strangely enough, women and men, Chinese particularly, are dressed in uniform and hats and their hairs, women's hair is probably shaved or brushed up inside the hat, it's very, very difficult to tell them apart. Very difficult. In fact, almost impossible, because many of the Chinese men were tiny, and of course the women as well. No, in the ordinary physical way is very difficult. Perhaps on occasions there were one or two that were outstanding, if I can put it that way. But apart from that, I doubt whether you'd know. But they were tough girls, and they marched, and they did the same sort of thing as most guerrilla women would do. They did the sewing, and they did and they'd fight. They carried arms, but they did all the cooking and carrying as well, I suppose.
Were there the same kind of rules that the Greek communist guerrillas had about keeping them apart?
Very much so, but this is the communist rule. I mean, the war is the thing, and there should be no deviation. There's no love life, no love affairs, no marrying or anything like that. Absolutely out, you see. It's an absolute communist law. I imagine the same in the Russian army during the war. Of course, what goes on the side we don't know, but strict rule is there's no division between man and woman. They're exactly the same in their fighting abilities and whatever they do. See, they wouldn't have any philandering, as we would say.
Which did you prefer, being in Greece or being in Malaya?
I was such a short time in Malaya, but I loved Malaya as a country. Most beautiful country and so well cared for. And the other surprising thing is how well the Japanese looked after that country. No destruction whatsoever. The roads were kept up, and the roads originally were looked after by the British, of course, the Public Works Department, were in a wonderful state. And the Japanese had looked after the roads and the buildings. The Public Works Department was still operating as though the British were still there. A bungalow which we took over from a Japanese general, which he'd used as his headquarters, was originally the home of the senior British surgeon in Alistair, and it was in the most beautiful condition, with lovely paintings, even a grand piano, carpets in perfect order. And the only way you'd know that the Japanese had occupied the place was a rifle rack by the front door for the guards. No, they looked after everything so well. The vehicles, the ones that they'd taken over, you know, because they didn't have much transport. The civilian cars were in marvellous condition. They kept them up beautifully. They were a highly disciplined crowd, there's no doubt about it. I mean, the Japanese officers really had power of life and death over those soldiers, you know. Don't question about that. No, it was an eye-opener to see that side of the thing. Singapore was just the same, absolutely spotless even then, at the end of the war. Everyone clean. Nothing like this country when you got home, how depressing everything was. They soon recovered from their war, the Malays, the Chinese.
Did you have any unusual experiences regarding
Yes, for a while it's operated, that's always the problem, unless you were in a town where you use the mains set, you use either mains AC, DC, or battery, depending on the plugs you used. But of course in Greece, no electricity, and certainly no electricity in Malaya, in the jungle. So we were left with a charging engine, which no one liked. It was a four-stroke motorcycle engine, about 350cc, coupled to a 6-volt Lucas dynamo, the sort of thing you'd find on an old Morris car, coupled with a rubber hose, which continually broke, and a regulator bolted to the frame. They were noisy, they were difficult to start, they had a long exhaust tube with a silencer at the end of it, but they were still very, very noisy. And this was the great thing, and of course, particularly in the jungle, the noise of a motor engine would carry for miles. So of course, no one liked this charging engine. But it was either that or a hand charger. And if you tried to charge a flat battery, with a hand charger, you were talking about days, not hours. And this is one of the reasons why I went into that jungle to re-establish communication. And it was there, of course, I found that the batteries that the operators were using were completely flat. They couldn't charge them again. The engine wasn't working, and so that was that. Now, before I left Colombo, I drew my stores from the SOE depot, wireless set and arms, various other bits of equipment. And then the officer in charge of the stores said, well, now we've got something rather special for you, a new sort of charging engine. And I said, well, yes. And he said, it's a steam generator. And I said, oh, how marvellous. Steam generator. He showed me the box, lifted the lid, and then inside there was this beautiful little steam engine coupled to a tiny dynamo. It must have cost a fortune to build in this steel case, all beautifully fitted in. And I said, well, isn't that marvellous? He said, ah, now, he said, wait until you see the boiler. The boiler was enormous, must have weighed about 60 pounds. Horrible thing to carry around. Anyway, this piece of equipment, the boiler actually contained the charging set, tucked inside the boiler, and the lid was